Francesco Ferretti is a lifetime marine biologist at Virginia Tech. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason at Virginia Humanities. The bald eagle has been the national bird of the United States since 1782, but just a few decades ago, it was on the brink of extinction. Brian Watts is director of the Center for Conservation Biology at William & Mary. He's been monitoring the bald eagle population in the Chesapeake Bay for 30 years, and he says the bald eagle is one of the biggest success stories in the history of conservation. Brian, for 30 years, you and the A-team have been looking for bald eagles in the Chesapeake Bay region. Tell me about the A-team. Who are you?
Yes, myself, Brian Watts, Mitchell Byrd, who longtime professor and eagle biologist in the region. Mitchell's now long retired. He's 93 this year. And our pilot, Captain Fuzzo. Captain Fuzzo is retired Air Force. He's flown all kinds of planes all over since the 1950s. So we've been together for a long time surveying eagles in the lower Chesapeake.
What kind of plane do you go up in, and how low do you fly?
Yeah, we fly in a Cessna 172. When we do the primary survey, which usually happens in March, we fly up and down all the creeks and rivers at about 300 feet. We come back in April to check on how many young are in the nests, and we'll drop down to each nest at that time and look right in and count the number of young. So we drop right down to tree level.
Are there moments when somebody lets out a little cry of joy, either at spotting a particular nest or a new nest or something unusual?
Yeah, there's always exciting times, you know, to come up on a nest and you expect to see an eagle and you may see a goose or an owl or something else in the nest, maybe a raccoon that's in a burrow. He's burrowed into the nest and there may have young ones that are looking out and you don't expect it. So, yeah, always exciting times in the air.
You know, I love the names of Virginia's rivers. So many are named by native Virginians. You have the Chickahominy and the Mattapony and the Pamunkey and all kinds of Indian river names. Don't you love that?
Yeah, it's just the lower Chesapeake is such a great place, the Rappahannock. And the Chickahominy is just a real eagle concentration area. There are places where we have multiple eagle nests where the females can sit incubating, looking eyeball to eyeball. The densities are just phenomenal there. During the winter, when the eagles take up laying eggs, it's just full of waterfowl in the winter. So it's just a great place for eagles.
How endangered were the bald eagles when you joined the A-team or when you started doing this mapping?
Yeah, the bald eagle population in the larger Chesapeake Bay was down to about 60 pairs by 1970 or so. At that time, the James River, including the Chickahominy, was really in desperate straits. The James River only produced 3 chicks over an 11-year period, and there was a 5-year period in the 1970s where there were no known breeding pairs on the James. We have just seen a tremendous revival of eagles here on the James and elsewhere in the Chesapeake. The Chesapeake Bay now has over 3,000 pairs, and the James River this year had over 350 pairs. So that's up from 0 to 350 in a fairly short period of time.
Why only 3 chicks on the James? Was that due to pesticides?
Yes, the James obviously supported a large population back in the 1930s onward until DDT was introduced into the James. And so by the time we get to the early 1960s, the population was in a death spiral. The population wasn't producing enough young to replace adult mortality, and so it was ratcheting down year over year.
What was DDT doing to eagles?
DDT inhibits a hormone that's responsible for calcium deposition in the egg, and so it was causing females to lay soft-shelled eggs. They were breaking in the nest, and it was also likely killing adults. In 1963, there was an adult picked up under a nest on Jamestown Island on the James River, and that bird was in convulsions and later died, and later was determined to have died from DDT poisoning.
There were even problems in the centuries before DDT. Tell me a little bit about what was wiping out eagles then.
Yeah, I mean, when you look back in time, there was a whole parade of insults to eagles, beginning really with colonial expansion and deforestation within this region and elsewhere, New England, for example. And then when you get to about 1850, the widespread availability of firearms became a factor. People began to shoot eagles more regularly. The fishermen considered them competitors for fish. Farmers considered them predators on their chickens and pigs. Fur trappers had problems with them taking muskrats from their traps. And so there was just a sentiment that from the mid-1800s to the early 1900s, that people didn't welcome eagles and shot them on sight. They would shoot chicks from nests and they would shoot adults for sport, but also because they felt like that they were competitors.
So here you are going out year after year for about 30 years with Captain Fuzzo, the pilot, and Mitchell Bird, the veteran birder. At what point did you start to realize, hey, they're coming back?
Yeah, it has been remarkable to see. The population really began to gain momentum through the 1980s. And by the time we reached the late 1990s, we had reached the recovery goal for the Chesapeake Bay. The Fish and Wildlife Service recovery team established an objective of 300 breeding pairs for the Chesapeake Bay. And we reached that by the mid-1990s. Now we're at 10 times that amount.
What, 3,000 pairs?
Yeah, 3,000 pair. The numbers continued to build. We reached a high in productivity in the late 1990s, and we've seen a retracing of that productivity. It's declined since about 2000, and it continues to decline.
Whoa, it's been declining in recent decades?
Yes, and that's one of the more interesting stories, what we refer to as the final chapter of recovery, and that is that once we reached the late 1990s, the population was growing exponentially, and we began to see a slow down, but adults were still producing a tremendous number of young. What was happening is the population began to run out of space, and so we created this large population of floaters, adult age birds that don't have anywhere to breed. And those birds were floating and putting pressure on the territory holders, and so we have this generational fight between territory holders and young floaters, adult age birds. And that has really caused a really interesting shift in behavior. Eagles have different jobs. The female stays typically on the nest. She's 30% larger and dominant. She really rules the nest. The male is the provider, and he goes out and forages and brings back food. When we had the appearance of the floaters on the scene, the male is then torn between going out and providing for the young and defending the nest from intruders. And so he began to spend more time at the nest defending, and so that's less food for the young. And what we've seen over time is an increase in failures, but also a reduction in the average brood size.
Have you seen fights between floaters and males guarding nests?
Many fights. So it used to be in the 90s when production was so high that you would rarely see the male at the nest. He was off foraging. Now he's there at the nest most of the time, and he is escorting birds out of the area repeatedly. And this time of year, so our eagles here in the bay begin to take up house now. They repair their nests and they're more attentive to the territory. Now, if you look in the air almost anywhere in the bay and just about any time of day, you'll see adults streaming across the sky. They're chasing and fighting for space. And so particularly now until about early March, if you pay attention, you'll hear them cackling overhead, and if you look up, you'll typically see one adult chasing another, and that chasing activity goes on for months up until the time that they have eggs and young.
How do you run out of space for eagle nests? Where do they love to build nests, and where have they adapted to build nests, and how would you ever run out as long as you've got shoreline for eagles to hunt and fish?
Yeah, the eagles defend a territory. Here in the bay, it's some of the smallest territories throughout the range, and that is a reflection of just how productive the bay is. There's just so much food available here in the bay that they only require a small territory, but they still defend those areas. And so there's only so many territories that you can fit along the shoreline. The dogma was that an eagle would require 1 mile of shoreline historically. That's what we thought. But the Chesapeake eagles and elsewhere have proven that not to be the case. We have nests now that are 150 meters away from each other. So they're really packing in tightly, but there's a limit to that.
How do you feel about the number of breeding pairs going from 3,000 to 2,000 because of fights over territory? Are you satisfied with that, or are you still alarmed at spreading development?
Yeah, you know, we used to be much more concerned, I think, in the 1990s about the implications of continued development within the Chesapeake Bay watershed. I think in more recent years, I feel that eagles are increasingly adapting to our presence. There are always going to be issues that we have to be vigilant about, and that we have to monitor new contaminants, other issues that emerge. But I really feel like our population at this point in time is so robust and so resilient that I don't see it going away anytime soon. I think if you're an eagle person, like some of us are, we're in a golden age. We haven't seen this many eagles throughout the U.S. since colonial times, and we may not have had the population size that we currently have because humans have made water features across the continent, so eagles are breeding in places that they didn't historically.
What do you think accounts for the phenomenal success of bringing the eagle back from almost extinction?
Yeah, you know, that is one of the most satisfying things about the recovery, and that is that eagles have recovered not because of the conservation community, but because of the American public. We decided back in the 1960s, during the sort of DDT period, that we truly valued eagles and we didn't want them to go down to extinction. And so there were two key pieces of legislation that happened during that time. One is that we banned DDT and like compounds in 1972. And in 1973, we passed the Endangered Species Act. Those two decisions really set the stage for the recovery that we enjoy today. And so the most satisfying and gratifying part of the recovery is that it's proof that we can work together to solve large environmental problems. At its essence, conservation is really us reaching out to another species to change their future. We did that with bald eagles. We changed the trajectory of an entire species. And looking back, it's really one of the biggest lasting messages of the eagle recovery. We can work together to solve these things. We did that.
That was Brian Watts. He's the Mitchell A. Byrd Research Professor of Conservation Biology and Director of the Center for Conservation Biology at William & Mary. In the small island nation of Sri Lanka, elephants are considered sacred animals, but Sujan Henkanategadira says the rich and powerful are illegally capturing wild and critically endangered elephants to keep as symbols of wealth. He and a team of activists and scientists are working to enact government reform to ensure the long-term survival of these gentle giants. Sujan is a biology professor at Longwood University. Sujan, you grew up in Sri Lanka. What did elephants mean to you as a child? Did you see very many?
Yes, so it's part of our life. It's part of the Sri Lankan culture. In major temples, both Buddhist and Hindu, they own elephants. So in Sri Lanka, one of the most sacred places is the temple of Tooth Relic of Buddha. They do several religious parades every year, and they use a lot of elephants. It's been happening for hundreds of years, so it's part of the tradition. And these elephants are dressed up. They are very sacred animals.
Sacred or just traditional? I mean, are they presumed to have special being?
Yes. So in temples, these animals are sacred. Typically, they get treated very well. But although we've been practicing this for millennia, things are changing because elephants are an endangered species now. There are some laws to keep them safe. But at the same time, both temples and some rich people, they keep elephants because it's a symbol of their wealth. Most rich people, they have like dedicated staff. Even in the temple, they have dedicated staff to take care of the elephants. That's the way it's been for hundreds of years.
How large is Sri Lanka? And about how large is the size of the elephant population there? And these are Asian elephants, right?
That's right. So Sri Lanka is a small island nation. The entire country is smaller than the state of Virginia. Now let's imagine adding 6,000 wild elephants and 22 million people into that very limited landmass. And I think you can imagine all the conflicts that would arise from that situation.
How many of those elephants are wild, would you guess?
So in Sri Lanka, the latest estimate is about 6,000 wild elephants.
Huh. How do you have 6,000 wild elephants surviving alongside 22 million people?
Yeah, so that's the situation. So and also, 60% of Sri Lankan land is the range of elephants. But at the same time, about 70% of elephants' range is occupied by people. So human-elephant conflict is something very serious in Sri Lanka right now. That's the root cause for all these conflicts.
How big is that problem, this illegal elephant trade, the capturing of young elephants in the wild so that the rich and powerful can have them?
Until recently, we did not know much about the extent of this trade. Our investigation was the first investigation into this matter. It's a little fraction compared to all the deaths. It's like 5%, but this is just the tip of the iceberg because we really don't know the real extent of this criminal activity because they have wide network and these smugglers are connected with politicians and people of power. And also from the other end, they are connected with the wildlife officers, park officers, and we are getting just a fraction of information. But the real story is much bigger than this.
Elephants are huge. How do smugglers secretly capture such a large and protected animal?
That's right. Right now, based on our data, they are mainly aiming the young elephants and juveniles, less than 5 years old. But still, these guys are big. So sometimes they would kill the mother and capture the baby elephant. Sometimes they sedate the baby elephants. And then we've heard that they've been using big SUVs and also trucks to transport these animals. Typically, they would capture these animals in a national park or a wildlife park. And we've heard that they are transporting these animals mainly at night.
Is the idea that there's a lot of money to be had by the people who capture and arrange for the capture of the elephants?
Yeah, that's the plan. As of now, they sell these elephants somewhere between $40,000 to $70,000 US dollars.
Give me a feeling for why, let's say, a wealthy Sri Lankan would want elephants and how that individual would keep them and display them.
So it's a symbol of their wealth. The wealth gap in Sri Lanka is enormous. So there's only like a fraction of people who can afford elephants and like welfare of elephants. But at the same time, there are some like traditional wealthy people and they've been maintaining elephant populations, captive elephant populations. Historically, of course, people captured some from wild, but the trend is getting out of control now.
Are there laws against the smuggling of these babies in the wild? And even if there are laws, do people really care that much? Because this idea of the rich and powerful owning elephants has just been a thing for so long.
So there's plenty of law. So, I mean, it's an endangered species under some international laws as well as the local law. There's like enough law to protect this animal and also to discourage the illegal smuggling of elephants from wild. But the problem is the enforcement. These smugglers, they are well connected with some corrupted wildlife officers. So the wildlife officers actually help them for bribes, I guess, to register these wild caught elephants as captively bred elephants.
What's your worst fear about this smuggling continuing relatively unchecked? What is your fear for the Asian elephant population of Sri Lanka?
So, I mean, these animals are majestic animals. They are smart. They have families. They have emotions. When you watch elephants, you actually feel it. You can see, I mean, they are just like us. They take care of their kids and they have friends. They communicate with each other. They love each other. So I think it's morally very wrong to smuggle a wild elephant and just selling it to somebody else. That animal would be in a solitary state for the entire life. So it's really hard to see how these people are separating these babies from their mothers. So sometimes they kill the mother and grab the baby. Sometimes they sedate the baby. And also, most of these babies, we think that they don't make it to the new owner. Some of these animals are, like, mostly it's our males. The changes of sex ratio can impact the long run of the population. Given all the other threats, like hunting elephants, killing elephants, wildlife trade, habitat loss, the future of Asian elephants in Sri Lanka it's not bright.
You and your team have come up with some recommendations on how to help conserve and save the elephants in Sri Lanka. What do you think can be done to protect these gentle giants?
Our recommendations are mainly to minimize the impact of illegal trade. So the first one that we recommended was to speed up the judiciary process against these smugglers. And the second one was take immediate action against those corrupted officers at the Wildlife Conservation Department. And also, I think the biggest challenge is we do not have an effective national policy about these captive elephants. At the same time, there are international standards. So we were basically trying to encourage the government to adopt those standards. Those were the main recommendations came out of our study. Right now, the situation is very sensitive and it's not going to the right direction. But we are very happy that I have a team of activists and scientists, and I'm trying my best to do some positive change, and eventually it may translate into action and we may be able to do something positive to conserve these gentle giants.
Well, Sue John, thank you for all you're doing, and thanks for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
Sue John Henkanatagadera is a biology professor at Longwood University. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, pioneering treatments to save lives and preserve brain function for stroke patients, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Maya Neer and Cassandra Deering are our interns. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
Stress. KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation.